My coworkers hate me for this. I often tell them, I say, I can do what you do. You can't do what I do. And so.
But yeah, but tell me why you say that. I want to know.
I say that because there is a particular thing that I think people of color and LGBTQ folks and people from diverse backgrounds bring into a space, that they bring into content that other communities just don't have because of their life perspective. We as minorities, as others, have had to grow up, particularly when we're talking about pop culture and we're talking about film and television, we've had to grow up seeing ourselves in these characters that don't look like us. Mm-hmm. White people haven't had to do that as well or right. as much as we have had to. And so what that means now is that I can take your art and your content and absorb it and make it apply to me, but I can also see how it applies to you. Oftentimes, white people can't look at our art and see how it applies to them. And so they look at yeah. our art as different or other or weird or alternative when, you know, we've been creating all of this since the beginning of time.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Am I Allowed to Like Anything? The podcast that talks to people about their work, their lives, how they're maintaining their optimism in this world, and what they're currently loving in culture right now, like actually liking. On today's episode, I have Travell Anderson on with me. Travell is someone who I've known for a couple of years and is a film reporter at the LA Times. And he specifically covers diversity in Hollywood with a focus on the Black and queer community. I talked to Travell about how he landed his job at the New York Times, but more importantly, in my opinion, how covering stories around diversity and covering stories around the LGBTQ community in Hollywood leading up to the Oscars So White hashtag really led to work at the newspaper that felt right on time, which I think is really important to note. And if you've been listening to this podcast for the past few episodes, at least, you know that I just cannot go without talking about my skincare and what I'm using and what I'm into. So enjoy. And remember to follow Am I Allowed to Like Anything on Twitter or on Instagram, whichever is your jam. On both, the handle is Am I Allowed, or follow me on Instagram at Darian. That's right. It's just Darian. All right. Now let's get into this.
First of all, I'm really glad to have you here.
I'm glad to be here. Finally.
I know.
We made it work.
We made it. Now that I'm here, the coolest thing about being here is it's a whole new just collection of variety of people mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. I can now interview.
Right.
Which
right.
is really cool. So I'm really excited to have you. You are at the New York Times.
LA Times.
LA Times. I can't believe. You know where? I had the stupidest epiphany yesterday. I was at a coffee shop or something like that, and I saw an LA Times paper. And I was like, so rare. I feel like I never see LA Times papers.
Yeah.
But it's because in New York the whole time I was seeing New York Times.
New York Times everywhere.
Anyways.
I get it.
You're a reporter covering mm-hmm. Black and LGBTQ Hollywood.
Yes.
And do you say LGBTQ? I feel like there's also another one.
There's a lot of letters that you could add to the end. LGBTQ okay. is kind of the most generally accepted inclusive form, but okay. you can go further and say LGBTQIA.
Okay.
You can go further than that if you want to, but I would say don't.
Okay. LGBTQIA.
Yes, that's the most inclusive form okay. that you can get.
IA, what does that stand for?
I is intersexed. A is, it can be asexual. It can also be ally, depending
okay.
on the person using it.
LGBTQIA.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, that's what you're covering
yeah.
within Hollywood for the LA Times.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into all of that, one of the reasons why I love you and who you are, and if we're talking about why I book people for this podcast, besides the fact that you work for the LA Times, it's mm-hmm. not about that, right? It's about how you've kind of grown and developed, I think, career-wise, but also as Travell
mm-hmm.
or Travell, as I want people to know. That's how your mom pronounces it. That's how we all should be pronouncing it.
She would love that.
Yes. But I just feel like you have been able to grow more into who you are while also like keeping a career mm-hmm. and like navigating that. So I want to talk about that
okay.
and what that's been like. But let's start with growing up in the South, in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was life like for you?
Life was, it was interesting. So I'm a military brat. So as you are, I believe.
Well,
did I make that up?
I'm not. No. Okay. Well, yes and no. So I'm not a military brat, but my mom now works on a military base. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My mom works on an Air Force base.
Gotcha.
My mom is an interior designer. Ooh. And I know it's crazy. And so she works with the architecture firm that's literally for the airbase. I mean, as you know,
gotcha.
Military mm-hmm. bases are like literally small villages.
There's
I feel
so much going on. Entirely yeah. too much. But yeah, so I'm a military brat. My mom was in the Army for 23 years.
Wow.
So I was born in Charleston, but kind of grew up and moved all over the place.
Where else did you move
oh God.
To?
Usually mainly across the southern area. So North Carolina, Georgia, Alabama. And then we pop back to those states every now and again. And then I also lived in Germany for a couple years. But then my mom has been in Afghanistan and Korea and Iraq.
Wow. Wait, I did not know that. Where is she based right now?
She retired last year
okay.
after 23 years,
oh,
thankfully.
After 23 years.
And so right now she's in Columbia, South Carolina with my little sister.
How old is your sister?
She is 16, I think.
That's how I am. People are like, how old is your brother? 23?
I mean, possibly. I could do the math, but like... Oh, she's 16. She's 16. Maybe not. Whatever.
Okay.
One of those ages. But it was fine. But I moved all over the place, so I wasn't really in South Carolina much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was about maybe 7 years total on and off. I lived with my grandmother when I was in South Carolina, so mm-hmm. she was a pastor, so I was going to church every single day. She also owned a restaurant, and so I was working at the restaurant every summer and after school. And so, yeah, I was a nerd when I was a kid, though.
I was going to ask you, what was your media appetite like as a kid?
I read a lot. I watched a lot of TV, a lot of movies, VHS tapes to be specific, mm-hmm. Of like Disney movies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just was somebody who preferred staying at home. I didn't really care to have friends. I just would, you know,
that
make friends
like
with
now.
Judge Judy and,
right.
you know, just Judge Mathis and Judge Maybelline Ephraim on Divorce Court.
How did you kind of take moving around so often? Like mm-hmm. for me, I lived in the same house my entire life until I graduated from college or from high school.
I think early on I hated it because I would, you know, make friends and then 2 years later you'd have to leave these friends.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got older, I think I just delved more deeply into books and homework and TV
yeah.
so that it didn't really matter as much. I had friends, but
right.
like my relationships with them weren't as tight or as strong as they perhaps could have been.
Right.
So when I left, it was just like, fine. And plus, I mean, everybody else was also moving around as well. So they were used to having to make new friends as well. We all were just kind of easily adapted kids.
Yeah. Okay. I really want to dive into this. Tell mm-hmm. me more about, I mean, you said Judge Judy, but tell me more about like what you were watching and what you were reading as a kid.
So, I mean, the main thing I can remember, there used to be this show back in the day called Noah's Ark. It was on Logo TV. It was like mm-hmm. a black gay Sex in the City.
What?
Yes.
Wait, I knew this, I think.
You've probably heard of it. That was like one of the foundational shows for me personally, just seeing black queer folks kind of living and being successful
right.
as their black queer selves. So that's something that I always remember. And then for me, I mean, my grandmother used to watch, you know, all of the judge shows. And so I would watch those with her. So it'd be Judge Judy. It would be Judge Joe Brown, Judge Mathis, and Judge Maybelline Ephraim on Divorce Court. And we would watch that because, you know, they would play those back to back every single day. So we'd watch that for like 4 or 5 hours after school.
Yeah.
Other things in the mornings, I'd wake up to watch Saved by the Bell. That used to be my go-to. And then Saved by the Bell, the college years, mm-hmm. once they started doing that. But yeah, and then just, you know, Disney movies.
Yeah.
Balto, Mulan, Lion King, obviously.
Right.
Forrest Gump, which is not a Disney movie, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So why Morehouse? Why was it Morehouse when you were in high school?
So I have a really... I know you've had other Morehouse people on this podcast before. I have a not... as wonderful story about why I chose Morehouse.
Okay.
Or the idea that Morehouse chose me.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I had a racist college counselor who didn't believe that I would get into the other schools that I was applying to. I was applying to predominantly white schools. And mm-hmm. she was like, oh, here's this black college. It's all men. You have decent grades. You should be able to get in without a problem. You're probably not going to get in to any of these other schools. And so that's why I applied. I got in and I ended up choosing to go to Morehouse because they gave me the most scholarship money. And so.
How about that? I can't believe I just did that. Oh, my God. Oh my God, I cannot believe I just did that. Am I the Catch Me Outside girl?
I mean, it's all right.
That, oh my God, I can't believe
she's penetrated pop culture, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh. Can we talk about how...
We can. We so can.
Okay. So, how many singles does she have now? I'm about to...
Is anybody even really listening to that? I mean, okay, obviously people are listening to it because didn't she get like a record deal or something?
She has a record deal. The Fader wrote about one of her songs, and I believe it was Rawia, who works mm-hmm. at the Fader, wrote about like her debut single. I think it was her debut single, and was like, I know we want to hate this song so badly, but it's kind of good.
Oh, is it good?
And like, I... Ugh.
Don't you hate when it's good?
I was so mad because I kind of agreed with her. But here's the thing. It's not good to the point where I'd listen to it mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm. But what made it so good is like whoever is doing her A&R
right.
is doing a good job because her videos look good. They look like highly produced, artistic, creative videos. Huh. And... it just makes me want to rub my temples. She has millions of followers on Instagram.
Oh, to be a white woman in America. Must be nice.
Anyways, let's get back to the story.
Yes, back to me. But yeah, so Morehouse. That's how and why I chose Morehouse. And my time there, it was an interesting one. My freshman year, I always tell this story. My freshman year was the year that this Vibe magazine article was written called Mean Girls of Morehouse.
Yes, I distinctively remember that.
Exactly. And so it was like, for the listeners, it was this story about this group of like gay and gender nonconforming students on campus who wore like women's clothing and got mm-hmm. their nails done and makeup and stuff like that. And so it was a conversation about how this all male, historically black campus is treating these gender nonconforming students. And so it kind of lit a firestorm on campus in right. terms of talking about, you know, how we as an institution treat and support or lack thereof our, you know, queer students on campus. And so that kind of just kind of informed my decisions about life and how I began to show up in the world and then the ways in which I began to kind of really accept myself and become unapologetic about myself in that particular way.
I have a two-part question. Mm-hmm. So I remember when that article came out, and I feel like after that, people started to kind of cover that about Morehouse, mm-hmm. like in some way, mm-hmm. just the different identities at Morehouse.
It was a national story. Right. CNN was on our campus a couple of different times talking right. about it. Like, it was a big thing.
It was a big thing because I don't think that people were really thinking about the different kind of identities at the school that kind of was... giving you this man in a suit mm-hmm. with a tie looking like he's about to go on Wall Street.
Right, right. That's what we were bred to become.
Yes. And so to me, it actually made me wonder mm-hmm. how did men who did not fit that image start to become comfortable with being their full selves at Morehouse?
Mm-hmm. Well, In that article specifically, the five or six folks that are interviewed in that article, they talk about some of them ended up transferring to other institutions in Atlanta. Some mm-hmm. of them talked about, you know, attempting suicide and being depressed because right. of not only just the environment at Morehouse, but also just kind of general life being a black queer person
right.
In America. I'll say for me, my freshman year, I wasn't necessarily identifying as gay then. Mm-hmm. I definitely wasn't gender nonconforming identified then. And I wasn't necessarily queer identified then. But through my time there, you know, it was basically me and a small group of students who were like, you know, the gay students on this campus need to be supported. And so we're going to start doing some action on this campus yes. to make the student body, the administration in particular, faculty and staff kind of, you know, pay attention and acknowledge that queer people are on this campus.
Right.
Queer people can be Morehouse men as well.
You kind of answered my other question, too, because you kind of said that your time at Morehouse helped to mm-hmm. shape mm-hmm. just like the queer person who you are today.
Yeah. So I was straight in high school. I had a girlfriend for 2 years and wow. everything. Went to Morehouse. Always kind of knew that there was a queer identity within myself, but, mm-hmm. you know, had some I said my grandmother was a pastor, right. So let your mind wander about what that could have turned into.
Yeah.
And so when I got to Morehouse, I wasn't thinking necessarily that I was queer, but then you go through life and you begin developing feelings for people and, you know, tapping into what you are attracted to. And then, I mean, I had always been someone who was just like very active in the spaces that I went into. And so I chose to be active in kind of the queer political organizing we were doing on campus. And that just kind of, you know, ballooned into me being a lot more experimental in my gender presentation and the way I kind of comport myself in the world. Mm-hmm. And the result now, I always tell people that Morehouse made me who I am, even despite all of the kind of homophobia and transphobia that, you know, myself and other students went through on that campus. They kind of allowed me to become comfortable with who I am and going into any particular space that I may go into right now.
I see. Mm-hmm. Basically, it also sounds like there was a tight-knit community of you to support one another.
Yes.
So it was like you had the community of people who did know who supported one another, but also like because of what you faced at Morehouse just as a whole or in different mm-hmm. kind of scenarios, you were still able to like familiarize yourself with some of the bullshit that the world would try to like pour you.
Very much so. I mean, it wasn't particularly in my class, but the class immediately after me and the class immediately after that one, we were bringing in a lot more openly gay students who had been out since they were 15.
I see.
And so they came into the institution just kind of carrying themselves very differently than I had ever kind of conceptualized. I had one openly gay student in my high school.
Wow.
And his name was Lloyd. He was everything.
Hi, Lloyd.
He was wonderful. But like, we just generally didn't have that type of energy. There were gay students on campus, mm-hmm. but they were able to pass as straight, some of them, okay. Or they were DL, or if they were openly gay, they were a lot more a lot more masculine of center. But we were bringing in students who are a lot more, you know, feminine of center, and so it just was like, you know, me, Marcus Lee, Kenneth Pass, Jamal Lewis, so many people at that school who were just like, we want Morehouse to be a home for us too.
Right.
And so how can we go about doing that? And so it was kind of one of those things like we were kind of fashioned through the fire and through the foolishness that we had to go through.
Through the fire and through the foolishness.
Hello?
You know what? I've been thinking about how I need to start titling my episodes with like catchy things.
Yes. Is that catchy?
That was so catchy. And we're starting today. We're starting with this episode.
Let's do it now.
Okay. So I know your history with how you started to work with the LA Times, but so I want to talk a little bit about that, and I want to also talk about how it evolved into your role right now.
Yeah, you cool. know what I mean? So I went to grad school at Stanford, and while I was there, I met this woman who's in charge of the internships and the diversity program at the LA Times.
Got it.
Didn't want to meet her.
Why not?
Well, I never thought I never wanted to be a newspaper writer. Like, who wants to write for newspapers? And I always thought I would be, you know, one of these cultural critic people at like The Atlantic or The New Yorker, writing for magazines, more long form type things. And I was like, don't want to do newspapers. But I basically had a couple people, like advisors of the program who I didn't like, and they didn't necessarily like me, but they were like, you know, basically, we want to seem diverse to this woman at the LA Times, so she'll keep coming back to our program to recruit. Can you go do this interview? I showed up to the interview in like sweatpants and a hoodie. Oh, I wasn't really feeling it, but I did it because they asked me to, but I didn't want to work there.
Right.
Basically, and I told her, I was like, I'm not interested in working at a newspaper, but, you know, thank you for taking the time out to see me. And she was like, well, okay, I understand that, but, you know, we have this diversity fellowship program that you should check out.
Oh my God. Wait, I like kind of cannot believe this right now. Because, okay, let's just go through everything that you have just said in the past minute.
Okay.
You're going to the school. Mm-hmm. You're going to Stanford University for grad school. People are not really fucking with you. Administrators are not really fucking with you.
Right.
This lady who is a part of or runs LA Times diversity and inclusion program comes to the school. You're not interested. These administrators who don't really fuck with you are essentially try to use you, as a tool to make them seem diverse to the LA Times. You show up in sweats.
That's true.
And let her know straight up, thank you so much for your time. I don't want to work on a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens?
Then it ends. She gives me this piece of paper that tells about the MetPro program, the Minority Editorial Training Program that the LA Times has. And I throw the sheet of paper to the side when I get back to my room. I don't think about it until later in the year. The time is coming for us to begin thinking about what we're going to do post-graduation. Right. And I'm like, okay, this program isn't necessarily helping me in the way that I thought it would in terms of like job placement type things. So what do I have? What quote unquote connections have I gained? The LA Times connect. It was a connection, though I had, you know, probably put my foot in my mouth in the interview. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to apply. It's a free application situation. The writing test that we had to do, I found to be very simple and easy. So I was like, why not? So I did it. I submitted my application, ended up doing, I think it was maybe two rounds of interviews, and they accepted me.
Okay.
And so I was like, you don't say no to the LA Times. Yeah. Like, I also don't have any other job. but also, you don't say no to the LA Times.
Right.
So I said yes.
I feel like I've definitely been in those situations before where it's been like, oh, do I really want to work at NBC?
Exactly.
Like, how ungrateful can you be? Anyways.
We're horrible people. Sound? I know. But it was like, I just knew that there's a general idea about what a newspaper is and the type of coverage that comes out of newspapers.
Yes.
And I did not see myself doing right. that. Fast forward, I start this, you know, fellowship program. It's a 2-year program where they like rotate you through three different sections of the newspaper. I did the Metro section. I did the entertainment section. I did the fashion section. I always knew I wanted to do stories around race and LGBTQ identity. Right. And I thought I was going to do it through the Metro section and local news. But the editor at that time wasn't interested in those types of stories. Literally told me that there weren't enough LGBTQ people and there weren't enough Black people in Los Angeles in order for me to focus on those stories specifically. And so I just like, oh, okay. Well, let me look at these other two sections that I've rotated through and see which section is interested in, you know, my vantage point and the types of stories I want to do. The entertainment section was very much interested in it. Mm-hmm. And as I kind of surveyed, the goal is to get hired out of the 2-year program, right? Right. So as I surveyed the entertainment team, I was like, what type of coverage aren't they doing so that I can make myself kind of indispensable to this team so that they're going to have to hire me.
Exactly.
They weren't covering Black film as richly as I thought they should.
Right.
And they definitely weren't covering kind of LGBTQ folks, in part because the industry wasn't really doing anything for LGBTQ folks. And so I started focusing on that specifically.
All right.
And then a thing like Oscar So White happened. And now
I was just going to say that. And you made the LA Times ready for that kind of coverage.
Yeah, they basically were like, oh, we've had this little Black boy basically doing this diversity coverage for a year or so now. He can continue doing that because now the industry is talking about it.
Yeah. As a milestone, Oscar's So White hashtag happened. Mm-hmm. And the LA Times was able to cover it properly because of you.
A little better than what they might have. I don't know if we did it. We've done it in the best way, even with me being there. But I do think that me being there has made our coverage better than what it would have been if I wasn't there.
True. I agree with that. And I just remember we got lunch at Guisado's and talking about, I forget what section, it was during your fellowship, I don't know what section of the paper you were in, but you were talking about what exactly you wanted to cover. Mm-hmm. And then I felt like the diversity issue, I have air quotes if you're not watching this on YouTube, the diversity issue started to become like a thing that people wanted to talk about within Hollywood. And then Oscar So White happened. Mm-hmm. And to me, such a testament of, I mean, to me, it's beyond kind of like trend forecasting or it's literally life.
It literally is. For us, it's
for
life.
For us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's really important to acknowledge that that was something that you were on top of and ready to cover like bravely and courageously. And you understood that this was something that needed to be done.
Well, it's just like, you know, we know that traditional mainstream media often doesn't cover communities of color well, mm-hmm. or LGBTQ communities or disabled communities, etc. And I thought that I could bring something to that particular perspective and vantage point in terms of coverage.
Right.
But really, you know, when it comes to Black film in particular, there's just like so much ripeness there in terms of content. You know, Tyler Perry's putting out a movie every single year and yeah. no one's covering him or those actors in ways that perhaps they should, despite whatever you think about Tyler Perry and his movies.
It's happening.
It's happening, and he's catering to a particular type of audience mm-hmm. that keeps coming out every single time. And there's a reason why he owns his own studio in Atlanta, and he can make a movie in 8 days like he did with Acrimony and Taraji P. Henson.
Yes.
Right? There's a reason why he can do that. And we need to be covering that, and not just, you know, the black publications or the black blogs. Mainstream needs to be taking, you know, notice of that as well.
Yeah. It's always something that I felt like Danielle Smith.
Icon. Everything.
Icon.
Legend.
I mean, where do I begin on who she is?
She's everything.
She's everything. She's a music reporter, writer, editor, author. Mm-hmm. Used to be the editor-in-chief of Vibe magazine. Put Barack Obama on the cover of Vibe yes. while he was a senator.
Yes.
And in addition to that, she's also the co-founder, along with her husband, Elliot Wilson, of Hardcover, which I have worked on.
Yes.
Anyways, why did I go down that rabbit hole of mentioning Danielle?
Good question. I think we were thinking of like just people who want to redefine media.
Oh, this is what Danielle would say to me. Yes. Someone who is redefining media.
Yes.
Something that Danielle would, and one of the reasons why she started Hardcover was because of communities that are underserved in media.
Exactly.
Whether it's through design mm-hmm. of their news, coverage of their communities, they're underserved, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
And so I think a lot about her saying that when I think about you saying, you know, mainstream media needs to be covering these stories alongside black blogs and whoever else may be that doesn't have the same depth of audience in
Very
terms
much
of,
so.
You know what I mean?
That's probably the greatest lesson that I took from my time at Stanford. I met Danielle while I was at Stanford. She was doing the Knight Foundation Fellowship.
Yes.
In which she eventually came with the idea for Hardcover.
Yes.
And we had this seminar where they would bring in journalists to our class every week to talk about their jobs and stuff like that. After the first or second quarter, we had not had a person of color. And I was like, this is not okay. I was always saying it was not okay, but
right.
at this point I was like, really, this is not okay.
And so I was like,
so I said, you know, we should invite Danielle. She's literally down the hall. She's been here just as long as we've been here, and I think she'd be a great, you know, person to cover, to bring and have this conversation with us. And one of the things she mentioned in that very first meeting was about how media in general could do a better job of covering communities of color.
Right.
And she took that and turned that into Hardcover. And so I'm forever inspired by Danielle and just this idea of like bringing more people into the mainstream.
Right. Here's something I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. So obviously a lot of people bring you on to talks and on to podcast appearances to speak specifically, I think, about just a black perspective or a diversity perspective on a number of topics within media. But I want to know, is there anything else that you would love people to call you to talk about? You know, and I don't know. I was just curious, like, is there something you're really into that maybe isn't specifically connected to
That's a good question.
Race or LGBTQIA community? I don't know. I was just curious about that.
I don't know. I mean, just general pop culture things. Like,
right.
I always tell people that I can, I often say this at work, and my coworkers hate me for this. I often tell them, I say, I can do what you do, you can't do what I do. And so, like, I like to think, I know it's so horrible and, like, cocky and all of that, but it's the truth.
But yeah, but tell me why you say that. I want to
know.
Well,
I say that because there is a particular thing that I think people of color and LGBTQ folks and people from diverse backgrounds bring into a space, that they bring into content that other communities just don't have because of their life perspective. We as minorities, as others, have had to grow up, particularly when we're talking about pop culture, when we're talking about film and television, we've had to grow up seeing ourselves in these characters that don't look like us.
Mm-hmm.
White people haven't had to do that as well or
right.
as much as we have had to, okay? And so what that means now is that I can take your art and your content and absorb it and make it apply to me, but I can also see how it applies to you. Oftentimes, white people can't look at our art and see how it applies to them. And so they look at our art as different or other or weird or alternative when, you know, we've been creating all of this since the beginning of time.
I think about that a lot. Like, even if I'm watching a movie, you're right. I've been doing it ever since I was a kid.
Yeah, very much
I've been seeing myself in these characters who typically don't look like me. Mm-hmm. It's almost this whole concept of, I always think about this scenario. Let's say you're, like when I was in college, I had, and even when I was in high school, I went to predominantly white high schools my entire mm-hmm. life. But obviously, like, I had black friends. I hung out with black people. But I was so easily able to go into white social white spaces, and it didn't make me feel uncomfortable mm-hmm. to be there because I was so used to it. But then I felt like I had so few white friends who I could bring into predominantly exactly. black spaces, and it was like just another day in the park. So it's that same concept.
Yeah, we are naturally reared, you know, code switchers, right? Mm-hmm. We can be in many different spaces and exist and thrive in all of those different spaces. And there are other people who haven't had to do that, right. you know, as they were growing up. And so they're not necessarily the most able to do it in their professional lives.
Yeah. What a word. Okay, I wanted to talk about a tweet
mm-hmm.
that it's actually not one of your tweets.
Great.
It's from Jason Parham, who is a writer at Wired. He's formerly of The Fader, Gawker magazine. I thought I had it pulled up, but I should have taken a screenshot. But something he said, really, I've been thinking about the entire day, mm-hmm. and I wanted to pose it to you and get your opinion on it.
Let's do it.
He says, last night's episode solidified it. Atlanta is centuries ahead of every other show. What we're missing is post-TV. It's genreless.
Mm.
So, okay, well, here's my first question. I guess it's not fair to ask you if you haven't been watching. Have you been keeping up with Atlanta?
I've been keeping up enough with Atlanta, yes.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. when he said that, I said, huh.
Yeah, it's something to ponder on, and it definitely is. One of the things that Atlanta has been applauded for is that it kind of has redefined what a television show could be, what a series could be.
Right.
In that it's kind of, the storyline is like loosely, you know, related throughout the every episode, but the structure of each episode is different. It's very experimental in terms of the things that they're doing and the stuff that they're talking about.
Right.
And so we really haven't seen anything like it before, and it probably is very much ahead of its time. And we probably, though we're loving it and lifting it up now, we probably aren't, you know, respecting it as much as we probably should.
Mm. Another thing I think about, too, is how he says it's genreless. To me, it's like I felt like at first Atlanta was marketed to us as a comedy, mm-hmm. specifically because of Donald Glover.
Right.
But if someone were to say that Atlanta is like a dark comedy, I would disagree with mm-hmm. them. I think that cinematically, like, it feels dark in this way, but essentially it is the life of three black men.
Right.
And if that feels dark to you, then that's the kind of conversation that we probably need to be having.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it feels dark to me in the way of, like, sometimes, like, Donald's life, quite frankly, sucks. And also, like, the way that it's filmed, I think it has, like, just, like, a darker, quote-unquote, feel to it. Mm-hmm. But it is genreless in this way where it makes you laugh, but it's also real in ways that feel depressing.
Yeah.
But it's also portraying black life in a way that is not being done in TV right now.
Very much so. Even with all of the great representations of black life that we do have, mm-hmm. right, in media right now, Atlanta is still kind of unique and different. And in and of itself, that whole idea of it being genreless, I hate, one of the things I hate in the industry, particularly in entertainment, is we always feel the need to, like, give things a category or a yes. title or a genre. And, yes. like, some things just don't fit into any of that.
Yeah.
You know, and language has yet to give us a term to define things such as Atlanta that blur the lines of genre. And so it's interesting just to see him kind of continue to develop the show, but also develop his other projects that some might say do closely adhere to certain genre type things. I'm interested to see where he goes from here.
Me too.
Because the industry is, you know, opening the doors for him in a lot of ways.
Right. One last question before we get to plus one.
Mm-hmm.
What is your dream right now?
Oh, God. My dream right now is to exist in a world where people allow bodies like mine to exist as they are. So if you didn't catch this early, I identify as queer and gender nonconforming.
Yes.
The way that I describe that to people is that as opposed to living in the binary of like a blue world and a pink world, a man world and a woman world, I'm somewhere in the lavender recesses of life, a mixture of both. So when you see me walk the street, you know, depending on what I have on, you might think I'm a woman, and I've gotten that a lot. Otherwise, you know, you might will see a man, a male identified person. And so my hope, my dream right now is that, you know, I could walk through the streets of wherever and not fear for my safety. I might have just taken this real far down.
No, now I'm just thinking about how much of what your dream is should just be your right.
Yes, it should be. It should be. Like, everyone should be able to just exist as they are in this world and move through the world in the ways that they wish to. But we know that that's not possible for many of us, not just, right. You know, queer and gender nonconforming people, but for a variety of quote unquote others. We are not allowed to just be. And I hate to say that that's my dream and that's the, like, you know, the biggest thing that I'm hoping for and wishing for. But after, you know, the looks that I get, the glares that I get, and the things that people say or sometimes try to do, right? It prevents you from being able to just live like everyone else. And so that's my dream.
Yeah. Okay, Jerome. We have now entered plus one segment space.
All right.
Talk to me about a person, place, thing, or experience that you are loving right now.
So I have two, but for the same reason.
Yes.
So Cardi B and Amara La Negra. I want to...
Who is that? Okay, please go on.
Amara La Negra is a... She's on like one of those Love & Hip Hop shows or whatever. Miami. Love & Hip Hop Miami. She's the Afro-Latina one,
yes,
with the big Afro,
yes,
right? Who has, you know, her storyline this season has been focused in part on kind of colorism and how she feels as if her time in the industry has been a struggle because she's Afro-Latina and she's not interested in, you know, and she's dark-skinned as well. And so she's not interested in downplaying either identity to be palatable.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently listened to an interview that she did on NPR about being Afro-Latina, Code Switch to be specific. And then Cardi B, I've been watching the interview she's recently been doing. And I just love that both of them are like women of color and they're unapologetically themselves.
Yes.
Like they're not trying to be buttoned up type of folks that you might think they should be because they're getting all this attention. They're still ratchet. They're still ghetto. They're still, you know, all these things that we typically see as a negative. They're doing it all at the same time and having great success at it. So I want to uplift them and, you know, all of the authentic, unapologetic, you know, folks who are just, you know, living life as they are.
Yeah. What I've been thinking a lot about specifically with Cardi B is how her rise to stardom has broadened what people in the music industry, mm-hmm, see and understand as commercially successful.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I feel like she's done it in a way that Nicki Minaj did not, mm-hmm, whether it was of her own fault or because of the people around her and the standards that had been put on her as a female rapper.
Right.
But I feel like the music industry is embracing more of this idea of different kinds of female rappers being able to make music, mm-hmm, that is on the Billboard Hot 100.
Right, exactly.
And I am just really excited to see where that goes. I was talking to a friend about how I feel like we haven't had another time where there was Lil' Kim, there was DeBrat, there was, like, who else? There were just, I mean.
There were so many.
There were so many. And, I mean, I think about Eve, I think about Trina. Mm-hmm. They didn't exist at that same time as Lil' Kim and Bad Boy and Mary J. Mm-hmm. and Missy Elliott. But I just feel like there hasn't been a time yet where there are different kinds of female rappers. Right. And also R&B artists that play in that hip-hop space, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. There hasn't been another time like that yet, I feel.
Yeah.
And I do hope, I don't know if it'll actually happen, but I think that my hope is that, I feel like Cardi B is such of this multidimensional person, and I hope that it allows for other kinds of female rappers to rise up and to make money,
right,
and to build influence,
right,
over people.
And not have to, you know, succumb to the industry pressures about what they should look like or what they should be saying or what they should be doing. Like, for their art and their personalities to, like, stay authentically theirs.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, my plus one. I always have to look at my phone. Because I take a lot of screenshots of the things I'm liking.
Mm-hmm. That's really smart.
Oh, I know exactly what I want to shout out. So as you may or may not know, I like skincare.
Yes, you do.
And I have been doing, I've been putting together these minute clips on skincare, different frames, different topics for my Instagram. The latest one that I've done has been on this facial roller, mm-hmm, that's made of rose quartz. Mm-hmm. On one side, it's like a shorter roller. On the other side, it's a longer roller. It's made by this company called Skin Gym. And I want to shout out that product because I feel like it's doing what it says it actually does. It helps to relieve tension in your face. It helps to, like, promote, like, the production of collagen, which is essentially, like, how you remain wrinkle-free and without lines, hopefully, or at least it slows down that process.
Right.
It's great for if you have sinuses. It just feels good on your face. If you have on like a moisturizer or a serum, it helps just with the absorption of that product. And so I just want to shout out my Skin Gym because I wake up in the morning, I pull it out of my fridge and I use it on my face. And it just makes me feel good.
I be watching your IG stories and your IG lives. And I be like, oh, look at her. Her skin's so flawless. Maybe I need to get me one of these roller thingy, my bobbins.
Yeah, listen, I am out here. I basically made an email that is automatically sent to you when you put in your email. And my email with my skincare routine is sent to you. So that's kind of life I'm on right now. Because people want to know.
Yeah.
The people want to know.
People want flawless skin like yours.
Exactly. Trayvell Anderson, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I felt like there were so many other things that we could talk about, but for the brevity of this conversation, I think that we nailed.
Yeah. We went all over the place.
We've been all over the place today. We've been around the world. And I'm grateful for your friendship. And I'm grateful that you were a guest. And I'm grateful to have you on Am I Lost Like Anything?
Thank you.
Yay! Thanks for listening to Am I Allowed to Like Anything? This episode is hosted by me, Darian Harvin, and produced by Jason Crow. If you love this episode, do us a huge favor and rate us on iTunes. It'd mean the world.